idea of those poets known as Black Mountain poets. Now, this is kind of, let's just forget that, I think. I'm not going to show you. But there is, as everybody knows, I think, in the school, that there really is no school or anything like that of poets all write in the same way or something of that kind. What we're involved in is a number of poets. There are two things we're involved in. One is a number of poets who are, in fact, associated with Black. I missed some notes here, so I don't lose my word. Who are involved in being taught or teaching at a place called Black Mountain College. Secondly, there's something else though, from what you said, and that is like those poets are associated with Robert Creeley's editing of the Black Mountain Review. And it's by no means like synonymous in any sense. I mean, sometimes they do overlap, but there are two things there. So what I thought I'd do was to play some of each to get an idea of the kind of thing that's going on. I thought, when I say first of all, because I don't have, I don't want to discuss the poems here, I think it's kind of ridiculous, is to say something about just what possible meanings that something like called some Black Mountain poetry area could have, and then leave it to you to see whether you agree or not. Let's get some facts out first of all. The Black Mountain College, in fact, there was a school that was in action from 1933 to 1956, which is quite a long time for a start off. And it changed hands, different teachers went there, different rectors. Charles Olson was the last rector. In fact, he still is, I gather. Technically, he is the last legacy of Black Mountain College. And even in his grave, gallows, the thing has not been settled. It's kind of strange. Like, he died holding Black Mountain in his hand. But I don't know what the clear up of that is, but he certainly was the sole legatee and the last rector. But the first one, of course, was a man called Rice, who was from Rollins University, Rollins College in Florida. So let me get some things like this straight, first of all. This was a college which was sited in some buildings called the Blue Ridge Assembly, which was being used for various reasons, in a village 3 miles from a village called Black Mountain, which is itself just somewhere outside Asheville, North Carolina. It was a village called Black Mountain at the point, that was where the school took its name. It took already existing buildings. Until new ones were built from an already Blue Ridge Assembly. Well, obviously, if it's from 1933 to 1956, that's darn near nearly a quarter of a century of action there. And I don't think it began to represent the kind of thing it represents for poets until the late 40s and then into the 50s. So I think we can seal up a little bit. Even that is quite arbitrary. But certainly it was a center in the first place of progressive educational ideals. That is, it was a place, a geographical and temporal location of intersections of American and European energies. I mean by that the first art director was Joseph Albers, who had already been associated with the Bauhaus. And the Bauhaus energies, a great deal of that, went into the concepts in Black Mountain. They went elsewhere in America. They went to Chicago Fine Arts Institute. They went to Harvard a little. But certainly, I think the Black Mountain was one of the places which, after the dissemination of Bauhaus action in the 30s by the fascists, that kind of progressive education thing, Black Mountain was one of the recipients of that energy in America. Then, of course, it generated, as you well know, I'm sure all of you, and fostered a good deal that became very important in American writing and visual arts. And also, don't let's forget, in the total theatre events, which are now called happenings. The first one wasn't called a happening. The first mixed media event was organised by John Cage in 1952, and included Robert Rauschenberg, painter, John Cage, musician, theorist, David Tudor, pianist, Mercy Cunningham, the dance maker, M.C. Richards, who was the potter there, training in pottery, wrote a beautiful book called Centering. And various other people, and Olson, who read his poems in it, of course. Which is, I think, 1952 then, gives you the idea of what was happening. There was a possibility there of an engagement between artists in various fields in that mixed media event, which was really the centre at that stage of what Black Mountain wanted to do, and that was to find a way of organising the arts together into a community. So the poetry function then began to have a major effect, I think, with the visits of Charles Olson, which began in the autumn of 1948. That was before he was rector, of course. Okay, how did it begin? The college began as a breakaway of students and faculty from Rollins College in Florida at the end of 1932-1933 university year, which is like June, I suppose, May, June. And it was not at all originally limited to just the arts. It was supposed to be, one of the first examples, it was supposed to be of the idea of contributing to the growth of the ideal campus. It was the idea of a university, and it is liberal ideas in action rather than in broad theory at all. It opened in 1933 with 19 students. 15 of them were from Rollins, the original college breakaway point. And it's interesting, I think they're important here, they were the majority were not Floridans at all, from Rollins College in Florida. They were from the Northeast America, these students. That is a very significant thing. They were already in that kind of area. Four of them were from Florida. Now, the basic principles in 1933 were these, and they more or less stayed in one form or another, that you would have intellectual training for responsibilities other than yourself alone. That emotions disciplined sensitively to through the creative arts primarily, but not entirely, would not be sufficient, that they would have to be connected with responsibility in a community of students and teachers in the first place, then extending into society. And they did this by having the community of students and teachers living very closely with each other. They were in contact continually, not in terms of like commuting to the university and then out again. They're living in the same buildings and so on. This was the idea from the start. That leads on to the next point, which is that the classroom and outside the classroom were not distinguished by boundaries. The idea was to blur and break the boundaries that traditionally grew up between class and classroom. Secondly, all the work except that which needed constant attention, like keeping the furnaces going, providing the meals, that kind of thing, obviously needs somebody there all the time to do it, more or less, was divided between the faculty and the students without distinction. And they started a small college farm in 1934, of which people were trained to work and so on, whatever you were doing in terms of like a central discipline. A lot of the reports on that that I read and people I've talked to, from that it's very clear this was the kind of problematic point for many people. They didn't think they want to milk cows when they want to paint and so on. That's, one has to say it wasn't all plain sailing by any means. Now, there isn't a book on that mountain yet, but Mike Weaver, down at Exeter University down there, it has done one, and I think it's coming out very shortly, but it's not already. So I should be most interested to see that. But just what happened there, then it has to be really stated somewhere. So far we just have a series. Okay, the idea for the artist in particular then, what was being trained, particularly in the 40s and 50s, was that the poet, the painter, the musician as a non-competitor. This is very strongly laid down in the teaching syllabuses and lectures that I read. The idea is that his own action is not a struggle against society or to find a way in society, but if there is a conflict, it's against his own inabilities and his own lack of knowledge. And that is, the creative act should not be against one's fellow man in a sense. So the teaching of the arts in Black Mountain is quite clear, was a very democratic action in that sense. It was not to be a peripheral thing, the arts, they were to be central. It was not to be some kind of bohemian joke, it was not to be some kind of entertainment factor. It wasn't to be like 5 minutes of cigarette before you sleep or something of this kind. Now this cut right across all the main line educational set institutions in which the arts are either academically slanty or tend to be peripheral in some way, you understand? And this, of course, made them a target for attack in many, many ways. Once you if you place the arts as central in the university education, you're asking for trouble. So Black Mountain was, in that sense, radical. This seems to have been the reasons, then, for the generative center which it became supporting the painters and poets. Let me quote you from the very first catalogue of the college, which was written by John Andrew Rice, the first rector, in 1933. He's talking about the arts being central at Black Mountain. This more or less stayed, too, even when Olson got there. He said the arts will be central because, in the first place, they are, when properly employed, least subject to direction from without, and yet have within them a severe discipline of their own, and because of their conviction that through some kind of art experience, which is not necessarily the same as self-expression, the student can come to realization of order in the world, and by being sensitized to movement, form, sound, and the other media of the arts, one gets a firmer control of himself and his environment, and is possible through purely intellectual effort. The last two points are these, that the student was free on these occasions, and the students in this case, many of them already practicing poets and artists, so one says students in a rather different way to undergraduate or something, you see. Chose the courses that he pleased. And the idea was, since his responsibility is to be placed where it belongs, you better start there and say, okay, let the kids choose what they want to do. choices then were his, although there was plenty of opportunity for guidance about the relationships of subjects and so on. But basically it was a question of not forcing the student in any way, but saying, okay, it's your responsibility, this is the advice. So that the artists were not forced to do what they didn't want to do. Also, it was because of the structure, generally, it was a centre of quite innovative courses. Let me just mention one, a man called George Zabriskie taught a course called The Psychodynamics of Creativity, which in 1944 was pretty advanced, ahead of its time. That is, he was considering pop art and beat generation art patterns and op art and so on, a general poetry and art course where people who were still refused by the academic community were already being taken seriously. This is 44, this is before Olson arrived. Already there was a modern poetry course which included William Carlos Williams, who hadn't written Patterson yet, understand, who's certainly not been taken seriously by the academics at that time. And also, though, of course, the general run of poets like Cummings and Stevens and Eliot, who were, to a certain extent, accepted by 44. But as Zabriskie says in his course, Cummings, Stevens, and Eliot were used as counterpoint to the others, Hart Crane, Williams, and so on. I mention that because it'd be a great mistake to say everything started when Olson turned up, although clearly a genius of that kind would direct in many ways the kind of activities going on for his own personality. Finally, let me give you a list, just to give you an idea here, of I've got some of the dates out, and some of them I find very tricky, so I'm not even bothered to date, of who was there and at what time. To give you an idea of the extraordinary range, as far as I can make out. Between 1938 and 1948, Joseph Albers was head of the art department, as I said. In 1944, Gropius was there, the great architect from the Bauhaus. Olsenfant, the painter, the purism painter and theorist, was there. And the dance maker, Agnes de Mille, was there. In 1944, in the summer, there Feininger, the German painter who came across, was teaching there, and Zeb Keen, sculptor, and Robert Motherwell, the American painter, was there. In 1948, de Kooning was there in the summer. In 1948-52, all those people I mentioned in connection with John Cage's happening were there already. That is, John Cage, David Tudor, Cunningham, Rauschenberg, and so on. And another composer called Lou Harrison, not terribly well known in this country, but an important American composer, certainly. In 1951, the painter Teodoro Stamos was giving art courses. And in the 52, besides the people involved in the happening, Franz Klein was there, and Tvorkov and others. I'm not quite sure the dates, but in those middle 50s period, in that late 50s, the late Black Mountain, early 50s time, Stan Vanderbeek, the filmmaker, was there too. Well, I can't quite check the dates here. It's been difficult, but he certainly was. 54, 55, the man in charge of some of the art department was Esteban Vicente, who was a leading American painter. And John Wieners was there, 55, 56, studying under Robert Duncan and Charles Olson, which he would tell a big deal about and talk to me. He remembers this very well indeed. And other contributing teachers who turned up from time to time, I just give you a list, were Buckminster Fuller, John Dewey, Louis Adamick. I don't know how much you know about American life, but he was certainly one of the leading leftist thinkers, like radical leftist thinkers. Eric Bentley, a British translator, art critic, and some, a drama critic. Philip Guston, a painter. Paul Goodman, everybody knows about. And students included Robert Creeley, who taught also later, Jonathan Williams, Fielding Dawson, Joel Oppenheimer, Paul Blackburn, and for a time, I think, Denise Levertov. I say because I'm not absolutely certain. So you see, it tended to be, once the thing got under steam in the late 40s into the 50s, then it attracted people who wanted to find a place where they could be active with other artists and learn. That is, not be on their own, just writing and publishing and rely on critics and so on, but to be in a place, an actual geographic place, where they could work out their own art forms. Now, the Black Mountain Review is something to one side of this, which overlaps a little. This Black Mountain Review was going from 1954 to 1957, edited by Robert Creeley, with contributing editors. Those among them were Allen Ginsberg, Irving Layton, Canadian Detroit, Charles Olson, Jonathan Williams, and Robert Hellman, who's a serious academic critic. And they printed work in the Black Mountain Review by a lot of these people that I've mentioned, but also by Louis Zukovsky, by Borges, by Kerouac, by Philip Whalen, by Ed Dorn, by Gary Snyder, by Hubert Selby, of Last Exit to Brooklyn fame, Mike McClure, and Michael Rumaker. Now, just I do this, I hope it didn't bore the hind legs off you, but it's just that I think it's important to establish just what those two things meant, Black Mountain College and Black Mountain Review. And it amounts to the fact that it was an incredible force for whatever reasons. But I don't think this is the place to discuss if you want to listen to the tapes. Now, what I've chosen is some tapes. I thought you'd like to hear quite a lot of Olson. So I want to start off with that pretty well. And so I got a tape of him, some tapes of him reading. And then, like, more or less play it by ear on this pile of tapes to see what we've got. But basically, to play some Olson and then work out to see how much time we've got and play some other things. Now, I want to start with a thing on my set, John, of a poem by Olson called Ode on Activity. I put it on this little cassette thing because it's a fairly decent recording, which in fact you made for me from the other tape. No. By the way, John Whiting, thank you very much. I forget, you're helping me out with all this as usual. Let me just try this out. A lot of the Olsen tapes are terrible, unfortunately.
All crowds rise and the three of us observe how fast Orion marks midnight at the climax of the sky. While the bed of the moon settles and red in the southwest as the orb of her was for this boy once, the first time he saw her whole Halloween face northeast across the skating pound as he came down to the ice, December, his seventh year. Winter in this zone is an on and off thing where the air is sometimes as shining as ice is when the sky's lights, when the ducks are the only skin.
there we are. He's reading, I thought we had a little more of Charles Olson reading. It's an important thing. He's reading the Songs of Maximus. Yeah, this tape is very bad, okay, but it's the only one. Now, I noticed that when Creeley was giving a talk on Olson, he was using this tape too. I think it's the only one around. terribly sadly. I wish I could find some more, but you know. And also, like, the, you know how it is, it's very difficult to get poets to read into microphones straight, particularly when it's Charles Austin and you can't tell him really, like, read into a microphone. So, like, let's remember who we're dealing with and try and get what we can from the tape. I just not apologising, just saying that it's not John's bad set that's on the tape. If you're reading the Songs of Maximus from the Maximus poems, and Maximus to himself, also from the Maximus poems, I think we'll just see how we get on after that, Tom.
Song one.
What's up?
I was pressing against this reel.
I'm sorry.
I just want to be sure I didn't damage it.
Colored pictures. Colored pictures of all things to eat dirty.
Where he says song one. Thanks.
Who knows?
You leave that on, John.
Well, good thing you, I didn't break your back. Song one. Colored pictures of all things to eat, dirty postcards, and words, words, words. Colored pictures. Colored pictures of all things to eat, dirty postcards and words, words, words all over everything. No eyes or ears left to do their own doings. All invaded, appropriated, outraged, all senses, including the mind, that worker on what is, and that other sense, made to give even the most wretched, or any of us wretched, that consolation. Greased, lulled, even the streetcars. Song? All wrong, and I am asked, ask myself, I too, covered with the gurry of it, where shall we go from here? What can we do when even the public conveyances sing? How can we go anywhere, even cross town? How get out of anywhere the bodies all buried in shallow graves? This morning of the small snow, I count the blessings, the leak in the faucet which makes of the sink time. The drop of the water on water is sweet as the Seth Thomas in the old kitchen. My father stood in his drawers to wind. Always he forgot the 30th day, as I don't want to remember the rent. A house these days, so much somebody else's, especially Congolians. Or the plumbing, that it doesn't work. This I like. I've even used paper clips as well as string to hold the ball up and flush it with my hand. But that the car doesn't, that no moving thing moves. Without that song, I'd void my ear of the music racket of all ownership. Holes in my shoes, that's all right. My fly gaping me out at the elbows. The blessing, the difficulties are once more in the midst of plenty walk. As close to bear in the space of sweetness, piss in the time of goodness, go side, go smashing, beat them, go as near as you can, tear in the land of plenty, have nothing to do with it, take the way of the lowest, including your legs, go contrary, go sing. I know a house made of mud and wattles. I know a dress just sewed, saw the wind blow its cotton against her body from the ankle, so it was sneaky, and her feet such bones, I could have had the tears that lovely peasant had, who couldn't unwrap it himself, had to ask them to on the schooner's deck, and he looked, the first human eyes to look again at the start of human motion just last week, 300 million years ago, she, was going fast across the square, the water, this time of year, that scarce, and the fish. I have seen faces of want and have not wanted the FAO apple seeds gone back to, but any of us, New England. You sing, you, who also wants. I've had to learn the simplest things last, which made for difficulties. Even at sea, I was slow to get the hand out or to cross the wet deck. The sea was not finally my trade, but even my trade added, I stood estranged from that which was most familiar, was delayed, and not content with the man's argument that such postponement is now the nature of obedience, that we are all late in a slow time, that we grow up many, and the single is not easily known. It could be, though the sharpness, the achote, I note in others makes more sense than my own distances. The agilities, they show daily who do the world's businesses, and who do nature's, as I have no sense I have done either. I have made dialogues, have discussed ancient texts, have thrown what light I could, offered what pleasures Dokiat allows. But the known, this I have had to be given, a life, love, and from one man, the world. Token. But sitting here, I look out as a wind and water man testing and missing some proof. I know the quarters of the weather, where it comes from, where it goes, but the stem of me, this I took from their welcome or their rejection of me, and my arrogance was neither diminished nor increased by the communication. It is undone business I speak of this morning with the sea stretching out from my feet.
That's all.
Vancouver. Okay,
Hey,
I thought, now, an interesting thing I thought would be, remember, I don't know, some of you remember this, I don't remember, I mean, maybe have it, an edition of the Evergreen Review, which was dedicated to San Francisco poets, do you remember that? But it was an issue that Evergreen brought out, I think, number two, right? Number two Evergreen
Review? Yeah, it was number two.
Oh, is it?
Number two.
Wait a minute, I've got the thing on it. Evergreen Review, number two, yes. 1957. I got that date. And the idea was that this issue of Evergreen Review, I've just got the center just torn out, was to recall what was going on there. And I've got it because I thought it would be a good idea to hear how these people sounded then. I think it's a bit of a cheat to play them now when they kind of gone on. So I thought how they sounded in 57, because the record was made, which is like impossible to get now. This is it, and I forgot on it, I thought you'd like to hear how Philip Whalen, Mike McClure, and Robert Duncan sounded in 1957, when they were kind of young. just see what you think about it. Anyway, I thought it'd be a good idea to play that rather than a recent work when really the Black Mountain thing is some time ago. So I thought it'd be a good idea to do that. So I'd like to put that on then, John.
Yeah.
So it's right from the beginning.
Okay.
If anybody would like to see it in part, this is show you the photographs of them when they were. Mac McClure was incredibly useful, I think. We'd like to pass it around there, and we've got the photographs and smile on there, inside. You can have, oh, that's for our lanternaires, I don't have any more.
What's the speed?
I think it's been a terrific quarter.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes?
The first part is Philip Whalen.
It wouldn't touch me, not with a habit I got.
That's William Burrow.
Alongside, shut her in.
Shut her in. Oh boy.
That's dear old Bill. Reading from Nova Express.
Sorry, I got the thing on. Familiar dulcet tones.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Sorry about that. I've got the reels changed. That, you know, when Olson wrote Projective Earth for that 1951 publication of it with Creeley, with ideas from Edward Dahlberg brought into it, that by that time it was already at Black Mountain a sort of going thing, and that was really a systematization in many ways of things accepted that they found already in John Dewey, which was the lecture there, and in some principles of Emerson, which Dewey took over. I'm not trying to say that Olson's Projective Earth actually wasn't innovative, in a knocking sense, but certainly that it was something that was already been in the air there and discussed there and then wrote out of the classes quite a lot.
Okay, John. Okay. Thanks very much. I'm sorry. What are you doing?
The Roadrunner for L.J. Reynolds. Shiny long bird with a taste for snake's eyes, frayed tail, wildcat claws, his pinions are bludgeons. Few brains, topped by a crown, and a flair for swift infighting. Try to take it from him. Homage à Robert Creeley. What I thought was a fly on the window was a knot on a branch outside. Near it a real fly sat, quiet in the sun. Wind rocked all the branches, the fly sat still. Small tantric sermon. The release itself, the comfort of your body, our freedom together and more, a revelation of myself as father, as a landscape, as a universe, being. This breaks down here on paper, although I am free to spread these words, putting them where I want them, something of a release in itself. All I can say is your foot braced against the table leg beside the bed, spinning your hips to admit my gross weight, the other foot stroking the smile of my back, a salacious picture of a man and a woman making out together, or ingenuous autobiography, memoirs of a fat and silly poet. It might as well show them gathering tulips or playing cards. To say concisely that the man in the picture really made it out through the roof or clear through the roof, the ground itself, into free space beyond direction, impossible gibberish no one can understand, let alone believe. Still, I try, I insist I can say it, and persuade you that the knowledge is there, that the revelation is yours. Michael McClure. Now, the eyes lay crooked and burn with it, that there's no meaning to this for which I've done, but the instant's meaning, burning like a candle in a black space, throwing the shadow of love on a waterfall of returns and leavings. But words are not cast, some of more or less of a meaningless image,
that I give you, that pain or music cannot keep us eternally or call back the dead hands to hold us. But I can't give more of myself to that moment than I give willfully, lovingly, that the image is only a fiery shadow. Cat's air. I'm rich with the music the cat makes at night, the delicate, tiny mew, as he wanders the room looking for love, quietly walking, sweetly mewing, a huge gray cat, not looking for sex, but looking for love, frightened of noises I can't hear, sweating, lost for love as he circles the bookcase. Night words, the ravishing. How beautiful things are in a beautiful room at night, without proportion, a black cat and a white spread, a black brown-haired cat with a sensitive human face, a white robe hangs on the wall like a soft ghost, without proportion, sounds go through my head, the room is calm and still and cool, blue gray stones, without proportion, the plants are alive, giving out voltage oxygen to the benevolent pictures above them. Songs put through my head. I'm taken with insomnia, with ambrosial insomnia, and songs put through my head. The room is softened, things are without proportion, and I'm asleep.
Put the Duncan thing on it. There's some of Creeley. This is again a bit of a cheat because this is not the Black Mountain time, but this is Creeley reading in Berkeley in 1965 from a book which became Words. Some of you know the book very well, you'll hear that in fact some of the stuff is very different. Some of the stuff is very different to the original, to the final version. Yeah. Okay, no, it's okay, then. Just leave it. Just leave it.
I feel very secure, and I want to put on this microphone for the others. I feel very secured by those who are here. I feel at home. What I'm trying to do now is to read all but a few, let's say, of those poems written since For Love. Because I'm undecided in the sense that this decision has already been taken from me insofar as these poems have been written. I can make no decisions about whether or not to value them for my own personal relationships, but otherwise they're here, so I'm curious to read them. The rhythm. It is all a rhythm, from the shutting door to the window opening. The seasons, the sun's light, the moon, the oceans, the growing of things, the mind in men, personal, recurring, in them again, thinking the end is not the end, the time returning. Themselves dead, but someone else coming. If in death I am dead, then in life also, dying, dying. And the women cry and die. The little children grow only to old men. The grass dries, the force goes, but is met by another, returning, oh, not mine, not mine, and in turn dies. The rhythm which projects from itself continuity, bending all to its force, from window to door, from ceiling to floor, light at the opening, dark at the closing. I have a nervous habit of interpolating all manner of extraneous material into this kind of performance, or reading more hopefully. But in any case, what I'd like, simply before I get too involved with it, to say that these now are poems which would have been written around 1960-61, about the time that I was first trying to write the island. And I'm now feeling them. They have a, they're really curiously irresolvable for me, because they are not, they're very oddly open. I don't think I've ever done anything with what they then proposed, except the novel seems to have been involved in what the writing then came to. They were doing all right. The rocks, trying to think of some way out, the rocks of thought which displace, dropped in, the water, much else. So life is water, love also has substance of like kind, wanting water a Sunday morning God will not provide. Is it my wife, her warmth lying beside me? Is that sense of warm moistness the condition in which all grows? Drop the rock. Think well of me. Water. The sun's sky in form of blue sky, that water will never make, even in reflection. Sing song, mind's form, feeling, if mistaken, shaken, broken water's forms, love's error in water. This particular poem is awfully hard to read, because it has a kind of rhythm that can be lost, it would seem. I think the rhythm fell clearest in the writing. I've not ever yet been able to go, the sun's sky in form of blue sky, that water will never make, even in reflection. Sing song, mind's form, feeling, if mistaken, shaken, broken water's forms, love's error in water. It's an awfully, the mountains in the desert. The mountains blue now at the back of my head. Such geography of self and soul brought to such limit of sight. I cannot relieve it nor leave it, my mind locked in seeing it as the light fades. Tonight let me go at last out of whatever mind I thought to have and all the habits of it. Waiting. He pushes behind the words, which awkward catch and turn him to a disturbed and fumbling man. What if it all stops? Then silence is as silence was again. What if the last time he was moved to touch, work out in his own mind, such limits was the last. And then a quiet, a dull space of hanging actions, all depending on some time, has come and gone. God help him then, if such things can, that risk is all there is. The invitation, if it ever is, as it will be, then enough is enough. They think in clusters round the interminable subject, all but lost to my mind. Well, here I am, they say, together, or here you are, them and it. Let's build a house of human pieces, arms and hair, not telling anyone, shout from the feet, face back to accumulations. We can do it, or and as it's done, what flesh can do, home again, we'll say, we'll fall down streets, rolling balls of clear substance. For William Carlos Williams, the rhyme is after all the repeated insistence. There, you say, and there, and there, and becomes just so. And what one wants is what one wants, yet complexly, as you say. Let's let it go. I want, then there is, and I want. Song. The grit of things, a measure resistant. Time's walking, talk speaking, telling lies, and all the other places, no one ever quite the same. The fire. Oh, flame falling as shaken as the stories my daughter sees in the light forming, seeing the simple burning as an action which to speak of, now I complicate with my own burning her story. Then it all goes, saying, here they were and are and will be again as I used to think to remember. Then they were here and now again they are. What in the light's form finds her face, makes of her eyes the simple grace.
Of Duncan reading the Venice book. Some of you may not have heard. I'll put it on there. Get in trouble. Just bear with me a minute. And the best thing to do is to play you the end of Ed Dorn reading some of his things. I can't remember quite how it's going, but I think it's alright. And then this leads directly on to Duncan, so we can hear Ed Dorn and then hear Duncan as well. These little things take time. I thought I'd play it by ear, really, rather than playing it. But then, this again, Dorn made this in 1965, and Duncan.
But they were, Duncan, the whole are all associated with this thing, so it's okay. But I think to play Duncan's, I think it's a good thing to play right through Duncan's, one of his early masterpieces, before Passages, before Roots and Branches, I think. I think it's represented at that time. It was in, wasn't it, that Ferlinghetti thing, which is now the print. Those little square city lights, pocketbook. And I think the Venice poem was in the Duncan that was in there.
It did Duncan,
didn't it? Yes, they did. It did Duncan. There, which is a very rare thing, Lee.
Isn't it, Larry? The Duncan one of the city lights.
They must have done one printing and not reprinted.
Right, it was a selected poem, and they really should reprint it. I suppose there are reasons that they're saying. But it wasn't the Africa poem, it was in the African Elegy, wasn't it? That really turned me on for the first time. I bought that right in San Francisco. It's squeaky noises. What's that?
I do it sometimes.
Well, you're the expert, John. I didn't realise you're set in the hotel really loud speaker.
Oh, sorry about that.
Right, because mine is deafeningly loud.
Oh. The tape was undermodulated a bit, actually.
But it worked on my set. It was made for mine, and worked on my set. We'll use this for the time being. Not really snotty reasons, but a bit louder. Yes. That was before Words was published. That's it. This should be Ed Dorn.
The vertically rhythmic tips of her fingers reluctantly off the stool, but he can't. He, the conservative underwriting buttress of our planet, can't. He has been drinking beer while she, too young for a public place, has been pulling a bottle apart in the car. Hard liquor. So there you are. She is as ripe and bursting as that biblical pomegranate. She bleeds spore in her undetachable black pants, and not to make it seem too good or even too remote or too unlikely near, she has that kind of generous smile offset by a dark and hostile look. Again, I must insist, her hair was black, the color of hostile sex. The lightest people, for all their odd beauty, are a losing game. I can't leave her. Her mother was with her. She, in the tavern in Florence, was ready with all her jukebox body and her trips to the car, to the bottle. There are many starry nights thus occupied while the planet, indifferent, rattles on like the boxcars on its skin. When moments like that transpire, they, with all good hope, begin again somewhere else. She made many trips to the car that night, an unmatchable show-off with her eyes and other accomplishments. And onward, bless us, there are no eyes in Missoula, only things. The new bridge across Clark Fork, there is a civilization again, a mahogany bar, a ticker tape, baseball, and the men are men. But there are no eyes in Missoula, like in Little Orphan Annie, or is the sky bigger there, really? Is the sky their eyes? The sky disdains to be thus associated in treacherous cowboys who drive cars, live there. Say the purity of blue over Houston, that unwholesome place is prettier. And the graininess over Michoacan is moodier, and I have been to Wyoming. The trip back, sadly, as all trips back are, dull, and I did see the old bartender woman of Florence, this time in her restaurant park, 50 yards away from the tavern, between which she ran apparently with the speed of some sort of stout gazelle, but not the broad with the fabulatory build. She that day was probably off in an office somewhere. But everyone was tired. We had unloaded the furniture early the next morning, and before the bite of the sun quelled the bite of the stars, we left, going the long, time-consuming way south. Sober business. The beauty of North Fork was there, as she will be till she dies sometime. And by the way, she runs a tavern. Thence to Salmon and across the narrow bridge and out into the Limhi. I say, if it weren't for the distances and for the trees and creeks, I would go mad. Oh yes, land that one forces a secondary interest in vanishes as a force as you drive onward. This is only obvious. This is only some of the times we spend. You go through it as though it were a planet of cotton wadding, and love its parts as you do the parts of a woman whose relations with Earth are more established than your own. But a physical entirety, there is no need to elaborate. One has one's foot on the ground, which is the saying of all common and communicable pleasures, and my arm around your shoulder is the proof of that. But I am ashamed of my country that, not as aerial reality, but as act, it shames me to be a citizen in the land where I grew up. The very air chills your bones. The very ungraciousness of its replies and the pressures of its not replying embarrass my presence here. God knows we do what we can to live, but the intimidations thrown at us, in the spurious forms they have learned truth can take, in a time which should have been plenty and engaging of the best, in that each man, if he were encouraged to be even that, and not slapped in the face as stupid, cut off from all other people to make him hygienic of views not viable to this soil, which is no more sacred, I tell you, than any other that earth has to offer, for she in her roundness has kept an accord with her movement's great time, has not yet seen aberrant. Mice crawling on a moving body, can they, may they really offset great movement? The very air, if you are awake, can chill your bones, and there is little enough of beauty finally scratched for. It is not the in pursuit of my countrymen that they be great in a great line of men. An occasional woman won't, though I wish she could, justify a continent.
In the parliaments of minuscule places she is there and gives them substance, as in Florence and North Fork, for she was gracious, as leaders are
now not, and I believe, and I begin to believe, after all these years, there is an aristocracy of place and event and person. And as I sit here above this valley I sought to involve you with and take you out on a trip that had no point, there remains Montana. And it is nice, but not infallible. The sky is a hoax and was meant, once suggested, to catch your eye. The eye can be arbitrary, but its subject cannot be. That's the beauty of some women. And from Williston, along the grand Missourian length of the upper plains you go, then the milk to Havre, that incredible distance, once along a route all those clamorous men took. They now grow things, they're not horticultural, only storageable, things of less importance than fur, for furs then were never stockpiled, it would hurt the fur. Astor would never have allowed it. And yes, Fort Benton is lovely and quiet. I would gladly give it as a gift to a friend, with pride, a place of marked indolence, where the river closes, a gift of marked indifference, if it were mine. If the broad grass park were mine, between the river and the town, and to the quick rise behind, and then up to the median altitude of Montana, sugar beets and sheep and cattle. Where the normal far are the stretches of Wyoming and North Dakota, Idaho is cut by an elbow of mountains that swings down, thus she is cut off by geology, she says, I'm sure, are natural, but it is truly the West, as no other place, ruined by an ambition and religion, cut by a cowboy use of her nearly virgin self, unannealed by a real placement, This is the birthplace of Mr. Pound, and Hemingway, in his own mouth, chose to put a shotgun.
that's that one. This is called The Sense Comes Over Me and The Waning Light of Man by the First National Bank. My stepfather stood on the corner by the National Bank, quiet. The hot lights, nights moved on between those weak periods. The old men spat. They seemed possessed of stronger points, a willingness to jut from their foreheads. Not articulation, but a world of determination, and only that, an insistence, a manifestation of the bottom jaw, then as now, the most stupidly local preoccupation. You think this is abstract? Nigger, no. Don't. There weren't. Not there, of course. We were alone, and it could be said there were questions unformed for the lapse of any plausible answer. The walnut dropped literally onto the ground in the woods and rotted there through the year, and the people cried out in their ineffectual way for white flour and pork. Canned peaches my aunt brought once was a ceremony. I almost waited under the table. The afternoons. So do you think to think of love, or weld that affair with the heat of ancient transplanted tassels, the relief of mystically rough elements, the dead watch of the sun, the unyielding severity of a farmer feeding pigs, the routine collection of mud mixed with the sharp green smell of excrement on their boots, old times gone over, save us from the anterooms of the moral plot, the shiftless witch everyone wore, blue jackets, coveralls, an unspoken sign in the starch. Laundry was very much, as now, a form of calculation, land and starch. This is no judgment. This is the weight of dissimilar things bound together by a strictly regulated common deprivation, the low and the high, no middle, held in a smiling equilibrium. You may eat only the shit I give you. One could not comprehend. Under a mulberry bush, the road was purple with their running from their farms into town. Passing at night on the road, the black road in the car, I marked the passing over those spots, under those boughs. It meant nothing. It could mean nothing. One would not have mentioned it. Abandoned, the trees were like my youth. It was a stain of assurance. I prefer to the cant on the bank steps, but an utterly sad and contemptible inability to insist on the stain of reality, and a woe of that lowly order became my sign and weight in that land. I became that land and wandered out of it, sharp and keen with the fever, this thrill of spring and the Lord's Prayer, which I carried and still love as a vague solace. I carry, confused, that ceaseless speculation over the ways of love into the darker borders of my wounded middle years, a practical self-pity. There was a girl who was a resolution, with whom I walked the empty streets and climbed the water tower for one night to show myself, she standing a white spot of summer on the ground. And I looked out, and as I did look out over the lights of a realm, I thought grander than and any of it altogether was very little. And when the pictographic scratches in the silver paint told me, as I walked around, the catwalk expression of what had happened in the 1930s, men vomiting from hunger on the thin sidewalk below, a lonely mason with his business ring on, but beyond, in the little shoe repair shops, the men, part of a hopeless vigilante, exhaling the slow mustard gas of World War I. My mother moving slowly in a grim kitchen, and my stepfather moving slowly down the green rows of corn. Those are my unruined and damned hieroglyphs, because they form the message of men stooping down in my native land, and father an entire conglomerate of need and wasted vision. All the children were taught the Pledge of Allegiance, and the land was pledged to private use. The walnut dropped in the autumn on the ground green and lay black in the dead grass in the spring. There they do lie, the principal residue of my past, in the past of my gutless generation. 19-year-olds invaded the White House today. A screen was put up to shield the nervous exit of Lady Bird. They sang and refused to move. She split, and I felt it possible again, at the end of a very long winter, to be a less schizophrenic American. A little of the pus was spooned out of my brain. I gave an arbitrary grade to a backward black girl. I remembered to spit on the sidewalk when I thought of the first 3,500 Marines who landed in Vietnam yesterday. I spoke of President Johnson as the logical extension of Increase Mather. My heart, like theirs, a civet box of sins. And late in the afternoon explained metamorphosis and Kafka as a product of a hung-up family and a hung-up people, bringing forward, inching nearer, the perpetuality of the lives we lead on the edge of the great American desert, where you certainly do not want to be buried, but buried you are. The horizons recede before you. They are busy with the presentations that remote of the tilting planes of escape, which are the speculation of what we might do, an imagination of the geometry of our location, the problem of the potato stamped to identify its place of origin, that, for one of the poorest of foods, no one has loved the West I came into. This is not a Shulamite maiden. Nor does anyone care to whisper this far into our ear. The allegory does not exist. The marriage will not come who would marry Simplot or Anaconda. I warn you, world of good intention, the birth of Mohammed will be fought in this neck of the cut-off world, devoid of the culture that spawned it consciously, and moved on. Any new blood will turn to an unnumberable plasma. We could still walk into the banks and demand the money, but the usual sadness. We have been preceded by Cosa Nostra. There is nothing so lame and halt as lateness.
I'm sorry about the first thing. It was I didn't give you the title of it. I forgot what was on it. It was from Idaho Out. The second part of it, okay, which is in the Hawthorne geography book. You alright then, Mary? Yeah, me too. I've been to the store. I'm not used to it. Okay, I think we might as well go on. I'm silent, just for my eyes. So. And this is in fact the longest thing. I'd like very much to do it.
Take a break or please speak up.
What do you think?
I know,
that's a break. Like a break, well, right. Let me play the Venice poem of Duncan, right? I don't think all people have, yeah.